Today is Friday, April 30th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinne Duofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, dozens killed in Israel religious festival stampede.
The National Emergency Medical Service said over 100 people have been injured, with dozens dead.
Also, President Joe Biden marks 100 days in office.
We passed the American Rescue Plan, one of the most consequential rescue packages in American history. We're already seeing the result.
Plus, Pope Francis cracks down on corruption at the Vatican. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Israel. Dozens of people were killed in a stampede at a religious bonfire festival in Israel on Friday, medics said, in what Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu described as a, quote, heavy disaster, unquote. Gloria Tso of Reuters reports.
Tens of thousands of ultra-Orthodox Jews had gathered at the Mount Moran tomb for the annual Lag BaOmer commemorations, which include all-night prayer and dance. Ecstatic crowds congregated despite warnings from public health officials. Witnesses said they realized people had been trampled when an organizer appealed over a loudspeaker for the crowds to disperse. The National Emergency Medical Service said over 100 people had been injured, with dozens dead. Witnesses said some of the victims included children. Police said Thursday they had arrested two people for disrupting officers' efforts to keep order at the site. Videos on social media showed chaotic scenes as ultra-Orthodox men tried to push through walls of iron to escape the crush. Bodies lay on stretchers in a corridor covered in foil blankets. As paramedics clambered to reach the wounded, police shut down the site and ordered revelers out. Military helicopters took the wounded to hospitals. The tomb at Mount Moran is an annual pilgrimage site, one of the holiest sites in the Jewish world. Private bonfires at Mount Moran were banned last year due to public health restrictions. The lockdown measures were eased this year as a result of the country's rapid vaccination rollout.
That's Gloria So of Reuters. Marking his first 100 days in office, U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to Georgia, a state where Democratic victories in the Senate allowed him to pursue a more ambitious legislative agenda. White House correspondent Patsy Widas-Kuwara has this story.
A campaign-style drive-in rally near Atlanta, Georgia, is how President Joe Biden celebrated his first 100 days in office. The state gave Democrats two crucial Senate seats in January, giving them a slim majority in the chamber and the ability to push the president's agenda.
And I want to stop here and give thanks to both your senators, Senators Ossoff and Warnock, for making it happen, because those two votes, had we not come back and you elected them, those two votes made the difference.
Biden highlighted his administration's achievements, including a vaccination campaign that has delivered 240 million doses and an economy that grew at 6.4% pace in the first quarter. He again pitched his $1.8 trillion American Families Plan to expand education and child care, financed partly through increasing taxes on wealthy Americans, and the $2.3 trillion infrastructure package he announced in March, calling it a blue-collar blueprint to build America. Todd Belt is the director of the Political Management Program at George Washington University.
He was trying to win back some of those first-time voters or some people who've left the Democratic Party because of losing jobs and losing opportunities in areas, particularly some of the Rust Belt states, which really held the key to victory in 2016 for Donald Trump.
A Reuters Ipsos poll shows 55% of Americans approve of Biden's performance in office, with the highest mark, 65%, for his handling of the pandemic. 52% support Biden's handling of the economy, but only 42% approve of his immigration policy, particularly with the surge of child migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border that has opened Biden to attacks from his own party and from Republicans. Republican Senator Tim Scott.
Weakening our southern borders and creating a crisis is not compassionate.
Biden has sent an immigration bill to Congress, but it's unlikely to pass. He has asked Vice President Kamala Harris to lead U.S. efforts with Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala, to address what the administration calls the root causes of migration, including poverty and gang violence. Patsy Widas-Kuwara, VOA News.
President Joe Biden took office 3 months ago working with a Congress narrowly controlled by Democrats. While Biden faced twin economic and public health crises caused by the coronavirus pandemic, Capitol Hill was consumed by the second impeachment trial of his predecessor, Donald Trump. VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson looks at the new president's dealings with lawmakers during his first 100 days.
Just days after the U.S. Capitol was stormed by pro-Trump rioters, America saw a peaceful transition of power to President Biden and a U.S. Congress narrowly controlled by Democrats. Lawmakers moved quickly to pass a $2 trillion bill to fund vaccines and send $1,400 payments to many hard-pressed Americans. President Joe Biden.
We passed the American Rescue Plan, one of the most consequential rescue packages in American history. We're already seeing the results.
Congressional Republicans said the massive bill did little to actually address the crisis. Republican Senator Tim Scott.
They spent almost $2 trillion on a partisan bill that the White House bragged was the most liberal bill in American history. Only 1% went to vaccinations.
Most analysts say the funding was a needed success for Democrats. George Washington University professor Casey Burgat.
It'll be treated as a legislative win and a popular one at that. This wasn't where expectation finally met reality.
But for the first weeks of Biden's presidency, the Senate was consumed by the impeachment trial and eventual acquittal of Trump for his role in the incitement of the January 6 riot. George Washington University professor Casey Burgat.
Congress was kind of reeling from this institutional question about whether a former president should or could be impeached. So there was some generally very bad blood between members of Congress as they're trying to transition into a new Congress, as they're about ready to welcome in a new inaugurated president who's coming in with a legislative agenda.
And while lawmakers were slower than usual to become organized, the politically unified Democratic Congress and White House, coupled with the management style of the new president, brought a different tone to Capitol Hill. Brookings Institution fellow Molly Reynolds.
When President Biden speaks or when someone says they're speaking for the White House, all of the players, Republicans and Democrats, have confidence that, you know, that's actually the position, that there's not going to be a sort of turn on a dime change of position.
It's an approach Biden will need as he negotiates passage of an ambitious infrastructure plan on Capitol Hill. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. President Joe Biden is touting a range of accomplishments as he hits the milestone of 100 days in office, but has he made any impact on the African continent? VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
President Biden has focused most of his energy in his first 3 months on taming the coronavirus pandemic on home soil. But in this short, frantic period, he's made a few important gestures that have been welcomed in Africa. On his first day in office, he halted the U.S. plan to exit the World Health Organization. Biden's reversal of predecessor Donald Trump's controversial decision to withdraw from the global body was greeted with near-universal approval, especially from African health experts, who said this could portend a more equitable world order. Biden also pledged an additional $2 billion to the COVAX facility, which aims to provide equitable vaccine access to poorer nations. Then, on April 20th, day 90 of his administration, he spoke words that appeared to resonate with many in Africa as he discussed the death of African-American George Floyd in police custody last year.
We can't leave this moment or look away thinking our work is done. We have to look at it. We have to look as we did for those 9 minutes and 29 seconds. We have to listen. I can't breathe. Those are George Floyd's last words. We can't let those words die with him. We have to keep hearing those words.
The incident was a linchpin for protests and calls for police reform in the United States. African analysts such as Asanda Gwasheng, a Cape Town-based diversity trainer and gender and race scholar, welcomed Biden's admission that the U.S. has a racial justice problem. South Africa is also struggling to overcome such issues after centuries of colonialism and the brutal apartheid government. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Pentagon is deploying hundreds of maritime, air, and land forces in Afghanistan as formal withdrawal of active troops begin. Officials say the fresh troops are to provide security for departing soldiers. Reports say heavy military equipment is being shipped out to meet President Joe Biden's September 11th pullout deadline. For more on the reactions of Afghans to the troops' departure, I spoke with Aisha Tanzim, VOA South Asia Bureau Chief.
In various ways for various people, so uncertainty about what comes next, uncertainty about whether the Afghan forces are capable of holding the Taliban back, uncertainty about how long can they hold the Taliban back, uncertainty about whether the international community's attention will remain on Afghanistan once the boots leave from the ground. So you find all kinds of opinions right now. There are those who are resigned to the fact that the Americans are leaving. And there are some people who think the government is capable of holding the Taliban back and the security forces will defend them and the status quo in some ways will continue. Others are hoping that there is a movement in the peace negotiations that are going on in Doha and that there is some sort of peace deal. But then there's those who are skeptical that the Taliban will really negotiate with the Afghan government. They think the Taliban are just biding time, and once foreign forces leave, they will try to take over the country militarily.
What about the assurances and reassurances of the American government, of the EU government, that they will not abandon Afghanistan?
Those assurances have done quite a bit to reassure both the government and the people, especially since they've said they're leaving, but they're going to continue supporting financially and otherwise. However, there is also this fear that these statements may be well-intentioned, but history shows us that the world in general has a short attention span, and especially when their own people are not here and there'll be other emergencies in the world and donations are already drying up for Afghanistan. They're not as high as they once used to be. The country is not just facing war, it's also facing drought, it's also facing, you know, internal migration. A lot of people need aid and that aid money is not as forthcoming. The world, as you know, is also going through a COVID crisis, so everybody's economy is under stress. So on one hand, the assurances have helped, but on the other hand, there's this fear that the world's attention span may not be as long as needed for Afghanistan to stabilize and get back on its feet. So it's a mixed bag.
That's my colleague Aisha Tanzim speaking with me from Kabul. Conflict and violence have displaced 370,000 children throughout the Central African Republic. The UN Children's Fund says among them are at least 163,000 children who were forced to flee widespread violence in the run-up to and following December's general election. Lisa Schneier reports for VOA from Geneva.
Protection is one of the most urgent needs, as internally displaced children face many dangers from violence, armed groups, COVID-19, and associated risks. Speaking from the CAR capital, Bangui, UNICEF representative Frana Kiza tells VOA insecurity in the country is increasing as armed groups become ever more violent. One of his major concerns, he says, is the risk of children being forcibly recruited by armed groups.
The uprooted kids, limited them, sometimes some of them absolutely with no parents around, made them extremely vulnerable to these movements that we have seen in the last months to be increasing in the country.
Since 2014, Ikiza says UNICEF has been able to secure the release of more than 15,500 children from armed groups. He says 30% are girls. He says the children are given psychosocial support, taught job skills, and helped to reintegrate into the communities from which they were taken. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is the Voice of America. German prosecutors have charged an Iraqi immigrant with membership in a terrorist organization on allegations that he raised thousands of dollars for the Islamic State group. Federal prosecutors said Friday that the man was arrested in early January on Germany's border with Switzerland as he allegedly was heading to link up with the organization. They said the suspect came to Germany from Iraq in 2016. Indonesia's military and families on Friday paid their last respect to the 53 submarine crew members who died when their vessel sank and broke apart in the depths of the resort island of Bali. The ceremony included relatives casting flowers in the ocean from the Navy's hospital ship. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Security concerns were raised among residents of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, after the governor of neighboring Niger State said Boko Haram militants had seized territory there. The claim made Monday in a widely circulated video said the Islamist group had raised its flag in the town of Kaure, abducted women, and sent thousands fleeing. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
41-year-old Enoch Obemiaso is more alert this week on his daily two-hour commute from his home in Tafa Village, Niger State, to the Nigerian capital for his printing business. Niger State authorities on Monday said Boko Haram militants attacked the town of Kaure, abducted women, sent thousands fleeing, and hoisted their flag. Obemiaso says the security threat means it's not safe to drive at night. Once it's 5 o'clock, I leave here. Now we're trying to see how we can arrange ourselves to form vigilante to protect ourselves, because this is not funny. Niger State Governor Abubakar Bello said at least 3,000 locals fled Kaure when the Islamists attacked and abducted an unknown number of women. Speaking on Lagos-based Channels Television, Bello said,
I've been engaging the federal government with, and unfortunately it has now gotten to this stage that if care is not taken, nobody, not even Abuja, is safe. Kaure is less than 2 hours' drive to Abuja, so nobody is safe anymore.
Nigerian military authorities denied the claim that Boko Haram had taken any territory and assured that Abuja residents are safe. Abuja Commissioner of Police Bala Siroma this week ordered stepped-up security patrols around Abuja's schools. Armed groups in northern Nigeria have carried out a series of attacks on schools since December, kidnapping more than 700 students, according to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. But authorities believe most of the attacks were by criminal groups looking for ransom, not Boko Haram, which usually operates in northeast Nigeria. But Beacon security analyst Kabiru Adamu says the militants could grow the area of the attacks if not soon stopped.
Unfortunately, something that may expand as we go further, except if the Nigerian counterterrorism strategy is able to prevent that expansion.
Islamic State West Africa Province ISWAP militants on Sunday attacked a Nigerian military base in Mainok in northeast Nigeria's Borno State, killing at least 30 troops. ISWAP, a regional offshoot of Islamic State, broke away from Boko Haram several years ago to carry out its own attacks on Nigeria's military and civilians. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Pope Francis has issued an anti-corruption decree requiring Vatican managers, including cardinals, to sign a declaration attesting they are not being investigated or have not been found guilty of terrorism, money laundering, or tax evasion. The new regulations are part of the Pope's long battle against corruption inside the Vatican's walls. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
Since his election in 2013, Pope Francis has been battling corruption inside the Vatican, and his decree, issued Thursday, mandates full economic disclosure and controls for all managers working for the city-state, including cardinals. They will be required to sign a declaration when they are appointed, attesting that they have never been convicted of a crime. They will also be required to declare that they are not under investigation for offences, including money laundering, corruption, fraud, exploitation of minors, or tax evasion. Vatican managers will also have to declare they are investing funds that are consistent with the Catholic Church's social doctrine. The decree also states that they will not be allowed to use tax havens or accept any work-related gifts that are worth more than $48. They must also not hold real estate obtained with illegal funds. Last May, Pope Francis issued another decree tightening the rules on Vatican departments to secure contracts. But the Pope's latest anti-corruption crackdown is the toughest since he took office 8 years ago to ensure Vatican City employees are not involved in illegal financial activity. For the past 2 years, prosecutors have been investigating allegations of corruption in a Vatican investment into a London property deal. The Vatican has been involved in numerous financial scandals, and the Pope has made clear he would battle corruption from the outset of his pontificate. Pope Francis has spoken about the issue of corruption on many occasions, One of those times was during a trip to Kenya, just 2 years after being elected. Cases of corruption, he said, are found not only in politics, but in all institutions and inside the Vatican as well. Corruption, he added, is something that hits us inside. It's like sugar. It's sweet. We like it. It's easy. But then, the Pope concluded, it ends badly. The Pope's new decree made clear that Vatican employees must adhere to internationally accepted regulations and best practices that require transparency to fight conflicts of interest, patronage practices, and corruption in general. MoneyVal, the Council of Europe's committee that evaluates anti-money laundering measures and the financing of terrorism, is soon expected to publicly release its report, which also includes details on the Holy See's adherence to combat those practices. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
NASA astronaut Michael Collins, who made history as part of the 1969 Apollo 11 crew to first land a person on the moon, has died at the age of 90. In interviews with VOA's Ken Farabaugh, Collins reflected on the importance of the mission and the contributions of the astronauts of his era, while keeping a focus on the future of crewed space flight and exploration.
Well, I was in this group here.
Yeah,
somewhere.
There you are. Michael Collins grew up with his sights set on the stars. But he joked the one he actually orbited, Earth's moon, wasn't the destination of his dreams.
I'm a Martian. I think Mars is the next great destination.
While he never set foot on Mars, nor the moon, Collins made history as part of NASA's groundbreaking corps of astronauts selected for the Apollo missions of the 1960s and 1970s. He was the fourth human to conduct a spacewalk during the Gemini program. But it's his role as the Columbia Command Module pilot during the 1969 Apollo 11 mission, when astronauts landed on the moon for the first time, that he is remembered for most. His job was to pilot the spacecraft, orbiting the moon alone while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin explored the surface. After a rendezvous, they all returned safely to Earth. Collins credited the thousands of workers on the ground at NASA for the historic achievement of their mission and the overall success of the Apollo program.
It was a wonderful example of organization within a large government agency. That's something we don't see too much of today.
After traveling around the world celebrating the Apollo 11 mission, he retired from NASA. While working at the U.S. State Department, Collins was tapped to be a liaison for NASA to the White House during the 1970 Apollo 13 crisis.
Houston, we've had a problem.
He updated President Richard Nixon on the status of getting the crippled spacecraft safely back to Earth.
And he wanted really somebody to tell him yes or no.
The answer was yes, and Collins believed Apollo 13, known as NASA's successful failure, was a turning point for American interest in crewed spaceflight.
It made NASA and the American public more aware of some of the hazards involved in flying to the moon and back, and I think it focused attention.
Collins wrote about his life as an Air Force test pilot and his missions into space and the moon in a 1974 book titled Carrying the Fire. In interviews with VOA, Collins preferred to look ahead rather than behind, and he said there was a lack of momentum and urgency in accomplishing new goals in space.
Astronauts and former astronauts, we're very pro-space, so I'm pro-accelerating the exploration of space.
Collins believed the planet that inspired him as a child, Mars, the subject of his 1990 book, Mission to Mars, should be NASA's ultimate focus. While he did not live long enough to see someone reach the surface of Mars or a return to the moon, NASA's Perseverance rover and Ingenuity helicopter on the surface of the red planet today are charting new frontiers in space exploration that have reinvigorated public interest. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Junior Duofo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great weekend.